Hennepin Avenue is Minneapolis's oldest street. In fact, it predates the city, though the exact number of years is anyone's guess. The track that became Hennepin originally was a Dakota Indian footpath that went from St. Anthony Falls all the way out to Lake Calhoun. On the banks of Calhoun was a seasonal hamlet called Cloud Man Village.
Well, the river was the primary method of transportation and actually food and shelter.
Author and Native American community leader Sid Bean explains the area's significance to the Dakota.
Well, the water was seen as spiritual. The falls were seen particularly as spiritual because as the water came and circulated, it gave off a strong sense of spirituality.
Geographically, St. Anthony Falls is unique because it's the only waterfalls on the Mississippi River. When surveyor Charles Christmas mapped out what would become downtown Minneapolis in 1854, he constructed a simple grid that followed the river.
Roughly, the plan was to create a square grid of avenues and streets that roughly parallels the river bank. And you can see where the river turns, the grid also turns. And that system was intended to be surveyed out for about a mile from the river, and then it would convert to a north, south, east, west grid configuration.
Philip Koski is a local architect and principal at Koski Architecture. He specializes in historic preservation.
Because it came first, just like Broadway in New York City or Market Street in San Francisco, you know, it was the footpath, the Native American footpath that connected two important places. So it's kind of like a cow path in that it finds the path of least resistance. So it bends and kinks a little bit, and the rest of the city grid came afterwards. And so the city grid has to kind of conform to the street rather than the other way around.
Hennepin's singular path is sort of poetic. Over the decades, the ethos of Minneapolis has evolved along the avenue. Just as surveyors and city planners couldn't contain Hennepin's physical form, city officials also have struggled to control eccentric and illicit elements along the avenue. Historian and architectural critic Larry Millett recalls Hennepin Avenue during the 1950s, before the city razored entire blocks of downtown Minneapolis.
Gateway District, there were all the girly joints. It's kind of the municipal id, the racier part of town. And it's in some ways the most natural and organic street in the sense that it's developed over time, different uses, and it's gone through all sorts of different lives the way cities do. And so it's a very representative street of Minneapolis for sure. You can find every aspect of the city's architectural history and probably every aspect of its social history along that avenue somewhere. Good, the bad, the ugly. Everything in between.
Hennepin Avenue gets its name from the Franciscan priest and explorer Father Louis Hennepin. Contrary to popular belief, Father Hennepin was from Belgium, not France. The confusion of his nationality can be attributed to the expedition which brought him to St. Anthony Falls. They journeyed for the purpose of exploring the North American waterways, which were part of what France had claimed as New France, hence the confusion. Hennepin was the first European to describe St. Anthony Falls. He wrote about the site in travel diaries, which became bestsellers in Europe. Sid Bean.
The spiritual relationship with which the Dakotas brought Father Hennepin to the falls, and he saw it in a spiritual way, and so he named it after a spiritual person.
Europeans settled the area that became Minneapolis because of St. Anthony Falls. The cascading water provided settlers energy necessary to build milling and lumber empires. In fact, Minneapolis was a world leader in the lumber industry during the first half of the 20th century.
It's one of the only reasons that the city is here. It's because of the power from St. Anthony Falls, first for lumber and then for grain. So we have a lumber exchange and we have a grain exchange. And then we have, you know, it's a financial center because all of the goods from the farm fields and from the forests came to Minneapolis. They came down the Mississippi River.
Today, there are several points in the Twin Cities to cross the Mississippi River, but the first crossing was practically on top of the falls. The Hennepin Avenue Bridge we use today is actually the fourth incarnation of the Father Louis Hennepin Avenue Bridge. Built in 1990, the present structure has the dubious distinction of being one of the shortest suspension bridges built in modern times.
I would say that it at best it's redundant. It's like a belt and suspenders.
Konski's view of the bridge is far more forgiving than others, like Larry Millett's. In his Guide to the Twin Cities, Millett calls the suspension bridge stubby.
You know, if you look at the classic suspension bridge in terms of its profile, it's still the Golden Gate, although its towers are higher than any bridge you would build for that elevation day, but precisely because of that, it's such a graceful structure, and that's the Brooklyn Bridge is another example of a very graceful span, but this one isn't graceful.
A suspension bridge is unnecessary for crossing this point of the Mississippi River, since the span between the east and west riverbanks is relatively short. While other more iconic suspension bridges stretch thousands of feet above the water, the Hennepin Avenue Bridge spans a mere 627 feet. So why a suspension bridge?
The current bridge that we see is loosely inspired. It's a suspension bridge. In fact, there were three suspension bridges across the Mississippi at this point, and one steel arch bridge, which preceded the concrete one that we have today.
Our current Hennepin Avenue Bridge was built with good intentions, as the arches give weight and definition to the avenue.
But it does create a more iconic presence than an arch bridge would. So that when you're looking down Hennepin Avenue, especially because of the slight kink when it hits the river, you can really see the bridge kind of terminating the avenue. And if you think of the grand avenues of Europe and Paris and London, they tend to mark the end of a major avenue with an obelisk or a triumphal arch or something like that. Well, here in Minneapolis, we have the bridge, which I think is appropriate because it also represents the fact that the river crosses there, or you're crossing the river at that point.
From the 1870s to the 1920s, transient laborers came to Minneapolis looking for work. Mostly single immigrants, these lumberjacks, farmhands, and mill workers arrived by train at three stations on the west bank of the Mississippi, which flanked the Hennepin Avenue Bridge. The bridge and adjacent train stations were a turn-of-the-century version of Interstate 90. Practically everyone who came to Minneapolis arrived through this corridor.
That's why it's called the Gateway District. It was Bridge Square was the front door to the city, because that's how most people would arrive here.
The Gateway District included about 25 blocks surrounding Hennepin, Nicollet, and Washington Avenues. Migrant workers spent most of their time here, and businesses specializing in cheap amenities flourished. The Gateway District was filled with flophouses, bars, and prostitution. Local historian Penny Peterson explains.
And what these guys wanted, you know, especially if you spend 6 months or so up in the woods under brutal conditions, is you want a place to have some fun. People found this very disturbing. So there's various plans to improve what we know as Bridge Square.
Bridge Square Park once sat on the plot of land that is now occupied by the monumental ING building designed by Minoru Yamasaki. In 1914, the city made an effort to clean up the gateway by developing two square blocks into a park across from the Hennepin Avenue Bridge. This park is one of the earliest examples of urban renewal in Minneapolis.
And this was to welcome people into the city. And there'd be this gateway pavilion, and there were public restrooms there, and this nice little park that you can see. And you think, yeah, that looks pretty attractive. But of course, there were all these migrant workers, and that wasn't quite as attractive.
Meant to conjure the great cities of Europe, a grandiose rotunda was built in the center of Bridge Square Park. But instead of cleaning up the area, these civic improvements attracted even more indigent men.
It just provided a place for the homeless men to hang out during the day and drink and to urinate in places that weren't accommodating that kind of activity.
Historically, Minneapolis has sought to mitigate its social issues by changing its physical landscape, and this has been especially true on Hennepin Avenue. Minneapolis Mayor R.T. Rybak theorizes it's part of our Midwestern ethos.
You know, it's pretty interesting because there is a long history of homogenization in Minneapolis with the best of intentions, where in our wonderfully orderly Midwestern kind of way, we sort of clean up for company, you know? And I think that's a little bit like what we've tried to do to sort of, we're a big city, so we're gonna clean this and do, and gosh, that's a big, wonderful part of what we do. But I think there has been this sort of undercurrent that's really been emerging a little bit more about, you know, let's kind of let this be something a little different.
By the late 1950s, city officials were increasingly frustrated by the homeless population that had dominated the Gateway District for nearly a century. They implemented urban renewal, essentially urban clear-cutting, which involved demolishing hundreds of downtown buildings.
And then everything from here to the river was free play for them to tear down. What I understand is that they didn't stop because that's where they wanted to stop. It's because they ran out of money to tear buildings down.
In the post-war era, downtown Minneapolis was becoming obsolete as a center of industry, as businesses like General Mills relocated to the suburbs. Fearing total abandonment, Minneapolis attempted to transform its downtown into a luxury business park. However, most of the space remained vacant. Look east from the corner of 4th Street and Hennepin today, and you'll see the results of urban renewal. A few new buildings amid a sea of surface parking lots.
They were convinced that developers would just rush downtown and put up a whole bunch of buildings, even though the population was going out to the suburbs, so like, why would they rush downtown to put up a whole bunch of buildings? And no one could really answer that question.
Until the 1960s, Hennepin Avenue was the city's main entertainment artery, with dozens of theaters and nightclubs dotting the avenue from the Mississippi River to the Basilica. Clear-cutting dramatically decreased pedestrian traffic downtown. Today, city officials are working to revitalize downtown Minneapolis and rebrand it as an entertainment destination. Mayor Rybak.
So it's absolutely my interest in trying to, build on some of those empty parking lots that won't happen overnight, but one by one over the years it's happened.
One building constructed in the wake of urban clear-cutting is the Yamasaki Building, which stands on the old Bridge Square Park. An updated Grecian temple, this building originally housed the Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company. Larry Millett.
Yamasaki, Minoru Yamasaki, was of course the same architect who designed the World Trade Center in New York. He designed these very tinsely, in some cases, buildings, these very ornate buildings for their period, but also very classical.
As you cross into the structure's portico, swooping columns drip four stories down like elongated incisors.
I love the building. It's high 60s, very much verging on the edge of camp. So I hope it has a long, long life, which I think it will. It's definitely one of the fine buildings of its period in the Twin Cities.
Another architectural treasure built for commerce is the old Lumber Exchange at 425 Hennepin Avenue. Because it was constructed on the west side of 4th Street, not the east, the building survived urban renewal and today houses downtown office workers.
Well, we had lumber before we had the milling industry. Most of the mills around St. Anthony Falls were built for the purpose of making trees into lumber, and then they were shipped out along the railways.
The Lumber Exchange was built in 1886. Several additions followed, including the upper two stories built in 1891. Variations in the masonry are visible from the exterior. Designed by the prolific Minneapolis architecture firm Long & Keyes, the Lumber Exchange is in the architectural style of Richardsonian Romanesque. Popular in the 1880s and 90s, it's easily recognizable by an imposing, sober masonry.
Some of the chief attributes are large Roman arches, which are the half-round arches, very heavy, rusticated stonework, so it won't be smooth, very massive and heavy with deep-set windows.
A number of Richardsonian Romanesque buildings were erected along Hennepin Avenue, including the Bellevue Apartments and the old Masonic Temple, which still stand today.
People would look at that building as opposed to some of the Victorian buildings of the previous style, and it would be a clear departure. And they would say, well, this is a modern building. And I think that a number of institutions and building owners wanted to make their mark. They wanted to be the newest, latest thing.
The Lumber Exchange was the first skyscraper built in Minneapolis. It's a testament to both the industry that developed from St. Anthony Falls and the immigrant workers whose labor made Minneapolis an economic center. City officials and immigrants often clashed, especially over vice. In the late 1880s, bars were strategically placed outside immigrant neighborhoods along the West River front, intersecting Hennepin Avenue.
Rationale was that they were going to get liquor out of the neighborhoods And so working men would not spend their paychecks at the saloons, and had an effect of concentrating the homeless, the drinkers. And you'd say, and you could go down to the old district limits and say, look at all these drunks. And again, this sort of forms your idea of Hennepin Avenue.
Minneapolis's gay community was also segregated on and around the avenue. Homosexuals went to the Gateway for activities they couldn't pursue in their own neighborhoods. The Gay 90s is Minneapolis's oldest gay bar. It sits on the corner of 4th and Hennepin, across from the Lumber Exchange. Originally, the Gay 90s wasn't a gay bar at all. Rather, the name references the 1890s. It became a gay bar during the disco era. Stuart Van Cleve is a Twin Cities LGBT historian and author of the book Land of 10,000 Loves. He says that another gay bar was once housed in the same building as the 90s.
Patrons of the happy hour would have to be very cautious walking past the Gay 90s to get to the happy hour because they were concerned that they might see somebody, you know, like a coworker, family member, or something like that. So they had to avoid attention of Gay 90s patrons as they passed by.
Gay men were segregated to Hennepin Avenue, but lesbians weren't around at all. A city ordinance meant to curtail prostitution prohibited women from entering gateway bars alone.
So two women could not enter a bar together without a male escort. A lesbian woman or a woman who desired other women and you took your date out, you couldn't take them out to a gateway district bar.
Though the 90s is the oldest gay bar in Minneapolis, the Saloon is actually the first gay-owned gay dance club in the city.
Back then, you didn't bartend in the city you were from. It was too dangerous.
That's John Moore. He and business partner Jim Anderson bought the Saloon in 1981. Unlike colleagues who worked at other gay bars, Moore and Anderson were the only out bartenders in the Twin Cities. Moore's business partner and co-owner of the Saloon, Jim Anderson.
We didn't want to buy the bar.
Yeah.
No, we were just angry. We were just mad at being used. We wanted some kind of justice. Thought it was time that gay people own their own spaces. We didn't think it was going to be us. Eventually, the idea started to sink in that if it was going to be anybody, maybe it should be us, because we had the experience and that we knew how to pour a drink, and we knew how to smile at people.
Anderson and Moore say owning the Saloon was an uphill battle. First, the city wouldn't grant the bar a liquor license. There was constant harassment from both the health and fire departments. And then there was violence, sometimes from the Minneapolis Police Department.
They come in a Saturday night at midnight and make us turn the lights off. They'd say they had heard there's a minor, some phony thing. New Year's in the early 80s, New Year's Eve, the police came here one night, the vice squad.
On New Year's Eve 1981, saloon bouncer Rick Hunter and his boyfriend John Hansen were brutally beaten by Minneapolis police officers.
So bloody, we had to call an ambulance and took him down to General Hospital. Thank God the nurses took pictures of him, because we sued the city and the police department.
The University of Minnesota's Treader Collection has a vast LGBT archive. Included are clippings and photos of Hunter and Hansen after the incident. Blood-streaked and broken, the men are almost unrecognizable. Hunter and Hansen sued both the city of Minneapolis and the police department. They won, but were still traumatized from the beating.
When all of this was said and done, John and Rick were so paranoid and so frightened, they thought they were being followed, they thought they were being watched, and eventually they, not only did they leave our employ, but they left the state of Minnesota and went someplace where they felt safe.
The fear really was so present. It was really a fearful time. And we were just trying to make it another day, another week, another month, and never thinking of it working out. It's just so dismal.
It's been more than 30 years since the hate crime, and things have changed considerably on Hennepin Avenue for the LGBT community. Today, the Saloon attracts patrons of all sexualities. Politicians campaign there, and cops frequent the bar too.
Last year, after Pride, some of the cops, when they were off duty, of course, had some cocktails in the back, and the younger ones, I was telling them stories about when the police used to raid the place, and their little eyes get so big, like they can't believe it, that this ever happened, that this happened here. But boy, it's a different day, and it really is the heart of the city.
It's the heart of the Midwest. There's nothing like Hennepin for 400 miles in any direction. If you want a party, it's here.
In the 1970s and 80s, Hennepin Avenue had lots of bars. including Moby Dick's, an infamous dive bar that offered a whale of a drink.
Fantastically sized cocktails of whatever you wanted. If anybody was got their 30-day medallion for sobriety, you could turn it in there for a cocktail. which is maybe why it's got a little bit of its negative connotations, but it was a bit of a free-for-all.
Local author and musician Paul Metza gigged at Moby's during the 1980s. He spent many evenings at the bar.
That's the place you'd go on Friday and Saturday night for a good time. It had one of the state's largest collection of foosball tables, and they used to have the Minnesota Foosball Tournament there. But it was really a collection of people from all points of culture.
It was also a point of constant conflict. According to Larry Millett's Guide to the Twin Cities, Moby Dick's generated up to 600 police calls a year, a municipal record. The north side of Hennepin between 6th and 7th Streets is also known as Block E. In addition to Moby's, the block had an eccentric collection of storefronts, including Rifle Sport Gallery and Schindler's Books.
Before the internet, when you didn't have the option of going and finding everything online, if you were interested in papers from other parts of the country, magazines that appealed to a particular interest that were fairly rare, a particular specialty, that's where you went to find that sort of thing.
A giant entertainment complex engulfs Block E today. Most consider it a failure, from its poor design and construction to a lack of tenants. Historian Penny Peterson describes the building.
I really don't know how to describe the architecture. Disney-esque, fake urbanism, all these fake false fronts, you know, implying that there's three or four different buildings there. It's just, you know, you paint it a different color, maybe it's a different building behind it, but it's just one giant megaplex.
In the years leading up to the demolition and reconstruction of Block E, future mayor R.T. Rybak served as development director of the downtown council. Rybak says that part of what prompted the city's decision to level the block was that several buildings had major structural issues and needed to come down anyway.
When I look back on that whole decision to tear down Block E, I don't think we would be well served today with one or two-story buildings and some vacant parking lots on Block E. That isn't a solution either. I think it was the right idea to move forward with something on it. I wish there would have been, this is before I got here, more of a push to do more connection to the rest of the city and not try to do this mega entertainment complex thing. But it happened, you know, and I understand the intentions. Now I think what we have to do is, as I say, just connect it better and surround it with success, which we are doing.
Displaced businesses were aided in finding new locations, but many believe that Block E was demolished to clean up and refine Hennepin Avenue. Once again, the city faced the challenge of developing prime urban real estate.
Of course, it was another empty space, which turned into a parking lot.
After a decade of waiting for White Knight venture capitalists to develop the parking lot on Block E, Minneapolis fronted $39 million to build an indoor mall. According to Mayor Rybak, the major challenge then and today is connecting Block E to the rest of downtown Minneapolis.
Block E does not have to be reborn as an entertainment center unto its own that becomes the catalyst for everything else. It needs to connect. And I think that's really the opportunity here. All surrounding Block E is doing fine. Block E is not. Well, in fact, half of Block E is doing great. Karen's, you know, I was had lunch there yesterday. That's doing great. So we've got to kind of like manage down this idea that you have to somehow have Block E be the catalyst that wins or loses Hennepin Avenue. It's a piece of a great avenue. And let's just, you know, fill it with a few good things at the ground level and not go nuts, you know.
Hennepin Avenue has long been an entertainment district. During the peak of vaudeville and burlesque, nearly 30 theaters lined the street. Today, only 4 theaters from this period remain. The Orpheum, State, Schubert, which is now the Kohl Center, and Pantages Theaters. Jim Anderson says that live performance still shapes the avenue's persona.
Years ago, we had Donna Summers playing at the Orpheum. Of course, it was the biggest night we'd ever had, you know. And there's, for us as a gay business, so much of what is happening at these theaters is of interest to our customers. So our customers are coming down to the theaters, and of course then they come and visit us before or after. So kind of saved what's left of Hennepin is what the theaters have done.
Until about 20 years ago, Minneapolis was focused on building a visually modern city. Restoration of rundown buildings was rare. Ginny Lakovic is a senior associate at HGA Architects and Engineers. HGA has been active in several of the theater rehabs, and Lakovic in particular was instrumental in the restoration of the Pantages Theater. Renovations to the Pantages took 3 years to complete, and early on, working conditions were rough.
The building having been abandoned for 20 years, it also had no light. There was no heat, there was no electricity, so we were doing it in the dark with flashlights. We surveyed the whole building. It took us about a year to actually get in and measure everything and just go through an inventory and look at every corner of the building. So you only ever saw a foot or two of the building at a time.
The four historic theaters were each part of different vaudevillian theater chains that populated the United States during the early 1900s.
A lot of these streets that that supported central theater districts, you know, they were referred to as the White Way. And that had a lot to do with just the amount of electricity that was being generated to try to get people to come to their particular theater. I mean, the signs got bigger, the lights got brighter, they flashed, they moved. It was, you know, it was so competitive to bring people in and to steal people from the next theater it just must have been fantastic.
Pantages was saved from destruction because most of the theater was hidden from street view. Once its marquee was removed, there was no sign of the old vaudeville house.
No one knew it was there. And the commercial space was viable enough to keep the building up and running without even needing the support of the theater. So it kind of became an afterthought.
Architecturally, the Pantages is unique. Designed by B. Marcus Petrica in 1916, it's more ornate than other Pantages theaters and one of the oldest still in existence.
The plaster detailing, just the level of detail, the amount of ornate detail is a little bit higher here than other theaters. A lot of the plaster elements are larger and just more theatrical. They're a little more commanding. It's very whimsical, it's almost mystical, magical.
Today, city officials are capitalizing on the area's arts and cultural legacy and rebranding Hennepin as the Avenue of the Arts. Mayor Ryback.
Let's listen to what a city is and let's let that speak on Hennepin. To me, that one of the places we wanted to speak a lot about is that this is one of the great art cities in the world.
There's also a resurgence in urban living. City Council member Lisa Goodman lives on Hennepin Avenue in the Bellevue. She says population growth is stimulating downtown Minneapolis's economy.
Well, we're seeing an unbelievable resurgence in residential living downtown. When I started on the city council and am a downtown resident, there were, 18,000 people living downtown. Now it's almost 30,000 people living downtown. We need to go to the grocery store. We need to find a dry cleaner. We need a tailor. We don't want to have to get in a car in order to find those services. So the answer to part of the downtown retail problem is dramatically increasing the number of residents who live downtown.
After a long and sometimes sordid history, Hennepin Avenue is coming back to life, growing and accommodating the diverse communities who live, work, and visit downtown Minneapolis. For KFAI, I'm Sarah Bowden. Miniculture from KFAI is made possible by listeners like you, and also from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.